It's the wake-up call we all need.
Time to wake up. When are people going to wake up?
Rush Limbaugh. Today at noon on 55 KRC.
The 55 KRC, the talk station. Friday Eve. End of the week is near. Louisville, I believe.
What the hell?
Yeah, that could apply to a whole bunch of topics this morning. Happy Thursday to you. Friday Eve, if you prefer, I do. Let's look forward to the weekend. Man, I tell you what, is it me getting old that these weeks just fly by? You just turn around and a week's over. Anyway, if you'd like to call, make a comment about what's going on in the world, particularly Louisville, hot topic this morning. Got a couple of police officers shot. Just after that, some were characterizing, if I may be loose, disappointing grand jury indictment of just the one officer. And wanton endangerment, the three counts of wanton endangerment on this Officer Hankinson, former Officer Hankinson, he was relieved of duty for the same reason that the grand jury indicted him, which is, I'm trying to envision this scenario. There were so many gunshots that rang out that night in this tragic, tragic, tragic case. And no one can deny it was tragic. But what we did find out yesterday, there was a knock. It's a no-knock warrant. And this has been the argument all along, and an argument that I embrace. You know, if a cop kicks in your front door unannounced and ununiformed, without a uniform on, nothing there to designate him as a police officer. I mean, who's to say in your mind that since they're breaking into your castle, whether or not that's someone coming in to do you harm or there to serve a search warrant? It's a little difficult in the middle of the night when these things go down. I mean, I don't even know what specific time that this incident happened. But I've always, from my perception, the Breonna Taylor's boyfriend, who's the one that opened fire on the police officers when they kicked the door in, I thought he was completely justified. Of course, he's not been charged. In fact, they originally charged him with, I believe, attempted murder of a police officer or something like that. And they dropped it because of the circumstances. Yeah. So we find out that, in fact, that they did knock. And I don't know if that alters the dynamic. It may very well. And, in fact, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend even acknowledged, for those who don't believe it, that there was a knock, acknowledged that he heard knocking, but he didn't know whether it was police officers or not. So merely knocking on the door procedure followed by kicking it in, I don't know that I can approve of that type of behavior, particularly if it's ununiformed or officers not in uniform. Come on, let's identify yourself very clearly. But former Officer Hankinson indicted on three counts of wanton endangerment from bullets he shot recklessly into the neighboring apartment. Now, they didn't get him on account of shooting bullets recklessly in Breonna Taylor's apartment. And I think the reason for that is because there was gunplay going on in there. And, of course, responding to gunplay or gunfire, you're going to have officers responding with gunfire. That's what happened. But this guy shot off 10 rounds, and a lot of them, several of them, went into the neighboring apartments, which obviously is a extreme concern to those living in the neighboring apartments. Hey, I got bullets flying in here. That's the wanton endangerment component to that. Obviously not exactly what the protesters were looking for. Very clearly not what the protesters were looking for. But a person is guilty of wanton endangerment in the first degree. And these charges carry up to 5 years in prison each. So there's potential for 15. I wouldn't hold my breath thinking that this officer is going to serve 15 years, three consecutive 5-year sentences. That would be throwing the complete book at him. Will they try to get a pound of flesh by doing that? I don't know. And honestly, I don't think it will satisfy anyone. He's not being convicted of murder in the death of Breonna Taylor. He hasn't been charged in anything relating specifically to Breonna Taylor. And that to the defenders of the folks in the street and Breonna Taylor's family and the lawyers is just not acceptable. But wanton endangerment of the first degree when under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. Extreme indifference to the value of human life. he wantonly engages in conduct which creates a substantial danger of death or serious physical injury to other persons. Shooting a gun randomly through walls and into other apartments, I think, qualifies pretty much as conduct creating a substantial danger of death. Undoubtedly. Was it extreme indifference? Well, I would love to know the trajectory of these bullets, honestly. And clearly the grand jury, at least I would guess the grand jury had it. And if Breonna Taylor and her boyfriend are over in this part of the room and a former officer, is shooting in a completely different direction, just sort of, I have this vision of him just randomly wanting, you know, just firing the gun any different direction. That may very well been of what happened, which again, why he was suspended by the police department in the aftermath of the shooting without really much delay whatsoever. So there you have that. And of course, we have these two Louisville officers that have been shot while responding to reports of gunfire during these protests. And I don't know if you saw any of the video of it. There were a whole lot of people out in the streets and a lot of anger, as you might imagine. Oh, and I did see the video of the U-Haul. Conveniently, the U-Haul was all prepped and ready to go for the protest. Lots of protest gear, including signs and probably concrete-filled water bottles. Anyway, they were well prepared for this. Don't know where the money's coming from or the organization, but they've been on alert because Louisville basically was locked down earlier this week. They put barricades up around. My recollection is I read somewhere where they boarded up the federal building, and my response to that was, is this the new norm? So we're going to have a grand jury come down at some point this week. We've been told that the grand jury investigation is going to get wrapped up, and so we need to board up the federal courthouse. Is this the new norm? Maybe it is. Certainly not a positive shift in the right direction. Anyhow, Chief Schroeder there in Louisville said in a news briefing the officers were receiving treatment at a hospital. One was alert and stable. The other was undergoing surgery. As of this morning, I understand that they are out of harm's way. Neither of them had life-threatening gunshot wounds. But the guns are out in Louisville. This occurred during the protests, and I don't know the motivations of the person who started firing at police officers. One can only presume it had something to do with the protests. It's frightening when you think about it. You got a grand jury proceeding that is held in private, and I've joked about these many times before. You can indict a ham sandwich if you're a prosecutor because you are in control of the evidence presented to the grand jury. And based on that, there are some cries now to release the grand jury testimony. Come on, show us what you showed the grand jury so we can get a comfortable picture that you didn't take a dive for the police department. I understand that skepticism. Grand jury proceedings are held in private. Barring that, I just kind of view this as one additional level of attack. So what do we have going on? We have every institution in America is under some form of attack right now. This is all that process of dividing us. So you have the attack on the election system. And then, you know, Donald Trump helps along with that one because he keeps talking about, you know, mail-in voting being fraudulent and blah, 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 or the potential for fraud. I share that concern. But that helps gin up the idea that the election is somehow going to be tainted. Both sides are guilty of that. We have the attacks on police, generally speaking, all across this great land of ours. And in fact, it was the subject matter of a Cincinnati City Council meeting yesterday by Betsy Sunderman's motion. And Betsy's going to be on the program later talking about it. Her motion, it's expressing the will of the council. You know, I hate those things because they don't really accomplish anything, but that they won't defund the police department. Of course, Sittenfeld and Seelbach got all Amendment-y, and they wanted to add their own language, and it resulted in there not even being a vote yesterday. But the idea that defunding the police has gotten traction, there's another institution they're going after. This is an attack on the criminal justice system. Now, this relates to police department, but, of course, the criminal justice system being the grand jury at least being cloaked in secrecy, invites a little speculation and skepticism. Skepticism, which I share. But we can't allow mob rule to determine someone's innocence or guilt. There has to be a process. And as flawed as our process may be, it's got to be like the best in the world. Maybe it's something more is going on here than the just Breonna Taylor. I think we can all arrive at that conclusion very easily. Just another attack on another institution. So who knows what's going to happen down the road? Of course, this officer is going to, I guess, learn his fate during the prosecution part of this. But what happens in Louisville on a going forward basis remains to be seen. Let's see what Jay's got this morning. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program and a very happy Thursday to you.
Well, thank you, sir. So, yeah, you're helping me segue into this. So I called you a couple of weeks ago when you had Jim Neal on there, and we talked to him about maybe running for a little bit of city council.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think he'll be defunding the police, and so, if you could, we've got a Facebook group going, Draft Jim Neal for Cincinnati City Council. And maybe you could talk to young Mr. Strucker there about, I did mention it to him about getting that link to that on your blog or something. That would be very nice. But what I heard from his advisors was that the feedback that he got was that it was very good conversation. And as you see, he has endorsed, Steve Chabot, who
yeah.
grew up in the neighborhood with us, who he's known his whole life. I think the way that we prevent these things from happening in city council here, the things that are going on elsewhere is the people of integrity.
Jay, picking people of integrity. Yeah. Someday I lie awake at night dreaming of people of integrity being elected to office. Yeah. Jim Neal would be a welcome addition to Cincinnati City Council. So my listeners know about the page now. You just told them, Jay. I'm sure we'll get some more lined up over there, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations. He didn't say no.
And...
Jay, you know, the Sheriff Neal did not say no.
He did not say so, no, and he's not the kind of guy that's just going to go away and do nothing.
No.
Like
he admitted that.
Forward there.
He's got bigger. He's going on to other things. He admitted that. So fingers crossed. I love the idea, Jay. Thanks again, man. Take care. It's 517, 55 KRCD Talk Station. Happy Thursday. Brian Thomas here. Appreciate the rundown Joe's put together today. Lots of good guests, starting with Dan Hills. FOP President Dan Hills at his appointed time, 6:30. Going to ask him about the raises. He went in the other day and said they're going to be hitting for raises during the collective bargaining. We'll find out how much he's looking for. Betsy Sunderman's resolution supporting the idea of not defunding the police and his response to Louisville and those officer shootings. Chris Whipple with his book Spy Masters. He had access to all the prior CIA directors and wrote about it. I'm going to wonder how much he couldn't include in the book because of state secrets. Anyway, Betsy Sunderman will be on the program at 7:40 to talk about her motion. Matt Burgess with Disabled American Veterans celebrating their 100th anniversary. 8:05 for that one. And our aviation expert, Jay Ratliff, with equal opportunity bird strikes. Yeah, Air Force 2 got hit. Department of Transportation, IG, talking about evacuation standards and, of course, a hub delay. What's going on in Ohio? Governor DeWine's issued a new order. The COVID-19 Dine Safe Ohio order. And I've got, from the Ohio Department of Health, their fact sheet. Question, can you serve alcohol anymore? It doesn't even address alcohol. Isn't that funny? But it does allow bars and restaurants to open at full capacity. I think the implication is here that you're allowed. Because if you're able to open at full capacity, that means you should be able to, what? Conduct business, part of which includes serving alcohol. Maybe the Patrick Kanan's appearance yesterday, the owner of Grub Pub, been around, little family place, got cited for serving alcohol after 10. So we had a real fun time talking with him about that. I asked him about his legal defense. Hadn't lawyered up yet, but I told him to make the argument in front of the Ohio Liquor Commission, who's going to be hearing this case, that the governor is unlawfully telling you can't serve alcohol after 10, or anyway, that has no force of law, and therefore if you do it, you can't be cited for doing it. There's no underlying authority. So I think what the amazing timing is, this came out yesterday after we had that conversation. So here's the change. Do restaurant? I'm just looking at the fact sheet. Do you have to wear facial coverings? The Ohio order requires employees to wear facial coverings unless they meet exceptions. Exceptions that really didn't matter at a football game here in Ohio the other day, where a woman watching her son play football got tased by a police officer for not wearing a mask. Turns out she was asthmatic. Do you think that one's going to go to a grand jury, Joe? Certainly hope so. You're going to have to put barriers. The holes in this are hilarious. It is recommended barriers be placed between booths, tables be smooth, easily cleanable, non-porous, properly clean between dining parties, comply with building or fire safety regulations. Shower curtains may be used if they meet these stipulations. How comfortable would you feel eating in a restaurant where you're separated from other patrons by a shower curtain? Anyway, barriers, this is the point I wanted to make here. Barriers made of fabric, cloth, or other porous material are not permitted. Joe, what's your mask made out of? Isn't that a fabric or cloth material? Can't use that as a barrier between people, but it's supposed to be the life-saving thing to keep it to yourself. It's only the beginning. Joe just commented, and I can't use his words. Yes, these are seemingly sphincter-inspired. You're supposed to have a COVID-19 floor plan. Floor plan should include at least the following. Number one, entrances and exits. I thought the fire code already required an ingress and egress point for all these restaurants and bars anyway. Can a food facility offer self-service food, drinks, or condiments? Yeah, for all you OK Corral, Golden Corral folks out there, yeah, you really want to know about that. Some self-service items are prohibited. All right. What's prohibited? Self-service condiment stations, bulk donut cases, roller grill stations, soft-service ice cream and yogurt machines, bulk food dispensers, and self-service stations that allow customers to help themselves to free product samples. So when you're we're walking around Costco, no more free samples. Now, soft-service ice cream and yogurt machines are prohibited. Are you allowed to then have self-service beverage machines? Yes, you are. So you can get a soda from a self-service beverage machine, which you know how it works. You walk up to it. You put your cup underneath it. You either activate a little lever or press a button. It dispenses the beverage. Isn't that exactly how soft-service ice creams work? But no, you can't have that one, but you can have the self-service beverage. All right. Salad bars are okay if served by staff within 6 feet of social distancing between parties. I don't even know what that means. They're going to go over and get your salad for you and then, what, throw it to you from 6 feet away? Just like, how much lettuce do you want? You want bacon bits? You want this Jell-O? It's red Jell-O today. It's 527 right now. There's more. 55 Garrison, the talk station, 749-5500. 531. Getting into local stories here, which I'm going to do, but just had to pass along this interesting United States mail anecdote. Since we're all counting on the United States mail to turn in these ballots on time or deliver them on time. And, of course, those decisions out of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan throw a huge monkey wrench into the whole works with their Supreme Courts just extending arbitrarily the number of days the Board of Elections has to count those votes. Anyway, on that subject matter, my wife gets a card from her mom. Arrived in yesterday's mail. Today is the 24th. Yesterday was the 23rd. You know what the postmark date was? The 1st. Joe guessed the 17th. I'd lie awake at night dreaming about postmates delivering within that short period of time. Came from a little town in Pennsylvania about an hour this side of Pittsburgh. That's where her mom lives. But it was postmarked. It was at the post office on the 1st of September, and it was delivered yesterday. It wasn't torn up. It didn't look like it had been lost. It wasn't trod upon or dirty. It looked like, you know, the card that it was. Anyhow, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost is trying to prevent the owner of two nuclear plants from getting the money that was in connection with that bribery scheme. First Energy or payments to Energy Harbor are what's at issue, and David Yost asked the Franklin County judge to block those payments. They own those two nuclear plants in northern Ohio. Unless lawmakers redirect the money, the fees are going to go to the Ohio Treasury rather than the Energy Harbor, previously called First Energy Solutions. Those fees, of course, at the center of that federal investigation implicating Speaker Larry Householder with the $61 million bribes there are alleged to have taken to help Householder win his leadership spot and pass the $1.3 billion bailout for the nuclear plants. So you think about return on investment, that if they hadn't been caught alleged bribery, you write a check basically for $61 million and it nets you a $1.3 billion bailout. Yeah, your market investments aren't going to get that kind of return ever. Stu Matthews, a lawyer that defended Ray Tensing, apparently he is now representing the former Louisville police detective who was indicted in the Breonna Taylor case just yesterday. Of course, Officer Brett Hankison indicted on three counts of wanton endangerment for shooting into the apartments near Breonna Taylor's. In other words, not in Breonna Taylor's, but because he randomly shot bullets that went into another person's apartment or other people's apartments. So anyway, Steve Matthews got another high-profile case. Congratulations, I guess. That just really puts the microscope on you, doesn't it? And you might be happy about this one, depending on your political side or your political point of view, which I don't think should matter when something like this. Don't go around trampling on people's yard signs, Republican or Democrat. Portsmouth man accused of stomping on yard signs in Madera, supporting President Trump, now been fined $250 plus court costs. A total amount, $305, part of a plea agreement. 40-year-old Aaron Brewer recently pleaded guilty in the city's mayor's court to disorderly conduct. Police Chief David Shaver from Madera said the charges of criminal trespassing and criminal mischief were dropped as a consequence of his agreement to plead to that. Caught on doorbell security camera, knocking over and stomping on several Trump yard signs displayed at the home of Madera. This happened on September 1st. Now, police have an ongoing investigation to who defaced at least 26 Black Lives Matter yard signs in the city over Labor Day weekend. Madera Police Lieutenant Paul Phillips on that job, he said, we're still attempting to identify the driver of the black SUV used in the offenses. If you got any information about that, you should call them up. Madera Police, 272-4214. Where is the guy from? Aaron Brewer. He is from Portsmouth. I have no idea what he's doing to Madera, Joe. No idea. Hey, that guy that tried to kill me on the expressway, Terre Haute, Indiana. Why in the hell was he driving up 71 in a stolen truck? Little Bird told me that he is going to perhaps enter a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity. I'm not kidding. 5:36 right now, 55 Care CD Talk Station. It's 5:41 right now, 55 Care CD Talk Station. Happy Thursday to you. Got a stack of stupid in front of me. But I also have Bob on the phone with a comment about the post office. Let us start there. Bob, welcome to the program. Happy Thursday to you.
How you doing?
I am well, and I sure hope you can report the same.
Well, hey, I had to get my new driver's license.
Yep.
So I had to miss a day's work to go get them. And I had to do the hazmat stuff, the fingerprints and all that stuff, so all said and done was about $150 plus missing a day's work. Well, they have to send you your driver's license in the mail.
Right.
Yesterday I get them. The envelope's tore open.
Oh,
it's all
no.
taped back together. It's got a little note on it delivered to the wrong address.
Oh, no.
Now, just imagine what they could have done with your driver's license.
Yeah, that's a little troubling, disturbing, Bob. I can't argue with you. I mean, sometimes things happen. I've gotten mail that's been sort of torn open or looks like it's been ripped up in, like, the mail sorting machinery or something like that. But honestly, that's never happened with a really important document like a check or a credit card or a driver's license in this case. But fortunately, I've never had to deal with a mailed-in driver's license before. Now that we've got those federal qualifying licenses, I think you have to they run you through a background check or something first. So that's why you have that
Well, I'm just happy it went to an honest person.
Of course, Bob. I don't know what they would do if they reissue one with a different license number or something, but, I mean, it is a photograph of you, so to the extent someone might be able to use it, at least you're covered in that regard. Best of luck, Bob. Well, just there you have it. The mail's not perfect. We all know that. Take care, man. Not an assault on the mail carriers, generally speaking. But had a listener call in the other day to one of the hoo-has in back room, claiming that she had ordered a whole bunch of Trump merchandise and it wasn't delivered. And this has been a long time, and she's thinking that the U.S. Postal Service has something to do with intentionally failing to deliver that. Anyway, we go to Vietnam, South Vietnam specifically. Starting off the stack is stupid. We go to a market in Binh Dong Province. I want to throw a huge measure of skepticism on this one, but it's the stack is stupid. So we don't always go with learned treatises and obviously reliable sources for these. But in the Binh Dong Province of Vietnam, authorities have seized 324,000 used condoms they allege were about to be cleaned and resold in the market. Binh Dong Market Management busted the facility in the province's Tan Vinh Heap Ward, in case for those of you keeping track. The facility was rented by Pham Thai Tan Ngoc, who is 32. Besides used condoms weighing 360 kilograms, this is about 700 pounds of you and me. Inspectors found thousands of condoms that have been packed and readied for sale without brand names. I think it was after they were cleaned, they were repackaged, Joe. Oh, that they weighed them. Well, that would have an impact, wouldn't it? Thank you. How can I proceed? Anyway, you know the skepticism I have? Who's going around picking up used condoms? Seriously. Well, I'm sure it is a government job in Vietnam. Don't give me any ideas here. 5:45 right now, 55 Care CD Talk Station. Loan One Mortgage, striving to give you the best mortgage experience you can. It is 5:49 right now, 55 Care CD Talk Station. Hope you're having a happy Thursday. FOP President Dan Hill's up at 6:30 on the motion that, well, wasn't voted on yesterday. Betsy Sunderman's council motion expressing the will of council to not defund the police department. Of course, Seelbach and Sittenfeld were responsible for that one getting tanked, at least for the large part. I got Stack and Stupid in front of me, but I got a Pat on the phone. Hey, Pat, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm well. I sure hope you can say the same.
Well, I've been better. First of all, I want to say happy belated birthday.
Ah, thank you so much. Yeah, celebrated on Monday, but I sure don't mind at all getting the happy birthdays late. Thank you, Pat.
Well, I would have called in, but I know your dad calls in on Monday.
Yeah, it's okay. That's okay. What's on your mind today, Pat?
I don't know if you can hear me because the phone.
Sure, I can. I'll let you know if I can't hear you.
Oh, okay, because the phone just went low or something. But anyway, I was calling about yesterday what. The Brianna case.
Yep.
And I'm sure you've been watching the details and everything. Brian, can I ask your personal opinion?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, don't you find it troubling that in all these cities that there is some type of, I don't know what the word I want to call it, but I'm just going to say chaos for right now, that's going on in all these cities.
Yeah.
And it's troubling to me to see that it's either the community or the police. I mean, I thought we were supposed to be the United States, the U.S. citizens.
Well, Pat, there are a lot of forces out in the world, both external and internal, that don't like the united part of United States. And the only way to deal with the problem that they perceive the United States to be is to end the united part. And this, I keep pointing this out over and over and over the weeks and last couple of years. There's so much division out there. It's as if you have a cause. Just pick one, LGBT or Black Lives Matter. It doesn't matter what it is, just whichever one you're talking about. If you're not lockstep in agreement with every single thing that that particular movement stands for, then you're part of the problem, and you're bad, and you should be shouted down, and you're evil, and you're blamed as being, you know, a homophobe or a xenophobe or whatever. That's the division. It comes easily with the internet. There are outside troll factories which perpetuate this nonsense. So if you dare utter a syllable about any topic worthy of discussing, you're going to get shouted down and ridiculed, and that forces you to go in a corner and keep your mouth shut. That's the reality of politics these days. It's a concerted effort by a lot of different groups, backed by a lot of corporate money. When I talked to Senator Rand Paul last week about this, you know, who's funding Black Lives Matter? And you got to remember blacklivesmatter.com, where they used to tell you exactly what they believed, and they don't anymore because they pulled it down. But funding that, because those groups are going to corporations and shaking them down and threatening with boycotts and threatening them with attacks. And they're like, okay, I'll write you a check. So you have Russians doing it. You have corporations facilitating it. You've got individuals like George Soros that have agendas that want to fund it, all of which seeking to divide and fomate anger and get rid of the united part. It's a lot easier for your enemies to run you over or call your entire system of government into question when the entire citizenry seems to be torn apart based on trivial matters, most of which are ginned up. There. Thank you, Pat. You let me vent my spleen this morning. Stay well, and thanks again for the well wishes. Got enough time for another one, I think. Well, I'm kind of along that matter. Seattle. I saw this the other day, and it made it to the stack of stupid. Seattle put on its payroll a convicted pimp who at one point vowed to go to war with the city. This is a $150,000 position. He calls himself the street czar. His mission? To come up with alternatives to policing. Random dude, former pimp, Andre Taylor. He actually was in the documentary American Pimp about his life as Gorgeous Dre. That's his pimp name, or was. He's getting $12,500 per month for a year. Comes a year after his organization, Not This Time, was paid $100,000 to sponsor a speaker series that was called Conversations with the Streets. See, Pat, look, more money. This one from the city of Seattle, going to pay one dude who apparently is well-connected with the streets, and that's his claim to fame. I know the streets. I grew up in the streets. I pimped on the streets, and there's allegations that he actually had prostituted underage women, too. That shouldn't matter, though. He's connected. And so we can put him in the stack of stupid and think Seattle is out of its mind because it is in the process of literally defunding the police department, only to put a $150,000 salary pimp on the payroll. He's connected. Let's take him at his word on that. This is all you need to do when you want to stir the pot and foment violence and anger. Find people who are connected with any given community. Pay that one person. And that one person uses their connections to organize, protests and riots and foment anger and get online and create, you know, and troll other people. It's a simple mechanism because there are so many people out there that are sheeple. They're going to listen to some person and say, yeah, man, let's do what that guy says. Yeah, well, that guy at least is getting paid. You're going to go out to the streets and riot and protest and burn and break things because some dude told you to do it and you're not getting 150 grand a year. I'd question your situation. It's 555 right now, 55 KRC, the talk station. I do know what you're saying. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK. We're going to be back right after the top of the hour news, and then Dan Hills at 630 on raises. Can you get a raise in a year of a $100 million deficit? I don't know. Dan will answer that question. I hope you can stick around.
It's the stuff.
I don't see how this Marxist revolution stops.
People are talking about
when President Trump is reelected.
55 KRSE, the talk station.
It is 6:05 coming up on 6:06 at 55 KRSE, the talk station. Hope you're having a decent Friday Eve. Stick around for at least a half hour here. Dan, FOP President Dan Hills, or just a little shy of a half hour. Dan Hills joins the program, or returns to the program, to talk about his request for officer raises, police officer raises. So timing of that discussion, excellent, because we are going to be talking about Betsy Sunderman's resolution that got shot down yesterday, the resolution saying that we won't be defunding the police department. And then we'll also get his thoughts and comments about Louisville. And, of course, didn't go the way a whole lot of people were wanting it. You saw the protests and the anger and two officers getting shot yesterday, which is really concerned me. You know, there's protests, and then there's violent protests, and then there's protests where people start shooting at each other. It seems to be spiraling downward. But Attorney General Dan Cameron said, you know, the decision before my office as special prosecutor in this case was not to decide if the loss of Ms. Taylor's life was a tragedy. The answer to that is unequivocally yes. I understand that Breonna Taylor's death is part of our national story, but the facts and evidence in this case are different than others. If we simply act on emotion or outrage, there is no justice. Mob justice, he said, is not justice. Justice sought by violence is not justice. It just becomes revenge. Now, in a rare moment of agreement, I am in agreement with Governor Steve Beshear. Daily news conference yesterday calling on AG Cameron to release the facts and presented for the grand jury. And the reason I'm in favor of doing that, we found out for the first time this morning, for maybe you or yesterday, the reporting talks about this and has talked about this being a no-knock search, that they just entered this apartment without knocking, without announcing their presence, and that they were not uniformed police officers. Well, as it turns out, even Breonna Taylor's boyfriend admits that he heard a knock. Now, he was confused as to who was knocking and whether or not they announced anything. Like, this is the police. We're here to serve a warrant. I didn't see anything correcting the notion that these officers were not in uniform. And I said all along on this one, if someone kicks in my front door and any reasonable person who's a firearm owner in the middle of the night is awoken to the door being kicked open, that you might open fire on somebody. This is why no-knock warrants are kind of a difficult thing to swallow from my perspective. You know what? Because sometimes they may come to the wrong place. Or, as is suggested by the attorneys for Breonna Taylor, that maybe the judge was lied to in getting the warrant. You have to have probable cause. There's criminal activity going on in the residence, and the warrant needs to be narrowly tailored to get the information the police are looking for. It was reported that drugs were around. There was a guy they were looking for who didn't live there. Wrong place. And if you're not involved in criminal activity, right, this goes to the point about defending yourself and opening fire, perhaps on a police officer who kicks in your door without a knock. If you're not engaged in criminal activity, why in the hell would a cop be kicking your door in? At least if you're selling drugs or you're harboring a known fugitive or you're running guns or committing some sort of ongoing criminal activity, maybe you're just some pervert pedophile downloading child porn. See, go ahead, cops, knock those doors down. But at least you're maybe aware that, well, yeah, I've been committing crimes and, you know, I guess I can understand why someone would kick my door in and want to serve a search warrant. That was not the case here with Breonna Taylor or her boyfriend. No drugs were found. There wasn't anything there. And, of course, her boyfriend opened fire at first, and then the one officer that got indicted for wanton endangerment. And the reason he got indicted on wanton endangerment, it's a 5 years per count potential jail sentence, is because this guy unloaded his firearm, apparently, and bullets flew into other people's apartments. And there were people living in those apartments. So it was the reckless disregard kind of thing. Recklessly fired into the neighboring apartment. He had already been fired from the job for doing that. So clearly the police department found out he breached protocol. And now we have that breach of protocol associated with a criminal charge, wanton endangerment. No charge against the guy for firing into Breonna Taylor's apartment. And I think the answer to that is because, well, they were being fired upon. Now, originally, Breonna Taylor's boyfriend had been indicted, or rather charged, not indicted, Kenneth Walker, and they charged him, but they dropped the charges for the reasons I just point out. If you come kicking in somebody's door, you know, it is okay and understandable for the a resident there to maybe open fire in an effort to, you know, protect his or her life. Let's see what Will's got this morning. Hey, Will, look, I saw you're up on the screen. I was looking forward to hearing from you today.
Good morning, Brian. How you doing today?
I'm well. I'm still well, and I sure hope you can say the same. I know you've got some friends.
I'm not too well. This just keeps reoccurring about every 30 years of my life.
This.
Like I'm saying, I'm just going to break it down real quick.
Go ahead.
This is the second case I've seen a young lady killed. And 1990, there was a little girl killed out in California named Letitia Harris. They gave her, the person that killed them, they gave her, 400 hours probation, a community service, a $500 fine that made them pay for the little girl's funeral, and probation.
Yeah.
So that's two black women, and all we got out of this was a fine, probation, and some community service. Well, so that's where we're going here, Brian.
A check for $12 million. I know they paid the family off for the wrongful death.
Okay, I got a daughter. You think money going?
No.
My child.
Hey, I'm not saying for a minute because I got kids of my own. Will, I know exactly where you're coming from on that. I'm just saying if you were rattling off what we got here, the family did agree to accept that amount in restitution, and I know it's not enough. It'll never make them whole again. This woman's life could never be replaced, but. You know, if that was included in the deal here. But the problem with all of this is, to me, they were at the wrong place. There's no accountability for that. So I understand the boyfriend opening fire. I understand if police are being fired upon, their desire to protect themselves and return fire. But none of this should have happened if they didn't screw up and go to the wrong place where this guy was not. That's the most trouble.
Nobody's going to jail, Brian.
Well,
nobody's in trouble for this girl.
Officer Hankinson, Mr. Hankinson probably will. I mean, he got indicted.
He's getting in trouble for shooting at the other people's apartments. Nobody's actually getting in trouble for harming this girl.
So if
and she wasn't holding a gun.
So if this
all
guy,
of them shot.
Yeah, back. I don't know if you know. I certainly don't know where these bullets went, why she was shot when her boyfriend is the one that was shooting at them. How in the hell this officer ended up firing 10 rounds and some of them went into neighboring apartments. I don't know any of it. And that's why I agree with Governor Beshear about releasing the grand jury information. That way you and I will know. I think transparency is most definitely needed here because, look, it wasn't until yesterday or today that a lot of us found out that they actually knocked on the door first. Previously, we were all led to believe they just kicked it right on in. So, you know.
Well, that's still to be determined because I had a question. And they said that they went over there and asked people, and they didn't. Nobody said it. Nobody said they heard it.
And so that's,
I don't really know. Everything's not out yet.
I know. And that's why I'm reluctant always to cast judgment on this. I understand in the law there are mental elements that need to be proven by the prosecutor's office in order to convict. We don't want to lock people up that aren't criminals. You know, I'm a big fan of criminal justice reform. I don't believe in the death penalty. You know why, Will? Because the prosecutor's office sometimes screws up. And lies. And sometimes innocent people are accused of murder and they get convicted and only by DNA evidence down the road after they serve 15 plus years. I think, oh, well, whoops. We're sorry, man. The state can screw up. The state can screw up. That's why I question the state at all turns. But, you know, I do believe in our criminal justice system for the most part. It is the best one in the world. But with the grand jury being completely secret, we don't know what information was given to the grand jury, and that's why, and I pointed out earlier this morning, I've joked in the past, prosecutors can say the same thing. I can get an indictment on a ham sandwich because I, the prosecutor, am in charge of what I provide to the grand jury. Now, does that mean you're going to get a conviction on the ham sandwich? No, you got to go before a judge or jury and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime was actually committed. But if you can get anybody indicted, that also suggests that if you, well, take a pass, take a dive, like a fighter going down to the third round just because the bet's on the other guy, you can present very little evidence, maybe not present all of the evidence to the grand jury, and the grand jury says, well, no, I don't find any probable cause to believe that a crime's been committed here, no indictment. But until we find out, we're left to guess. You and I don't know. Where did those bullets go? Why in the hell wasn't the boyfriend shot, and why did she get shot? She's laying there. She got all the bullets, six of them. One of them was fatal.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I share a lot of your concerns. I'm not ready to burn the city down as a consequence of this, but more transparency would benefit everyone, both sides of the ledger and even those standing in the middle that don't have an opinion on it. Stay well, Will. It's always good hearing from you, man. Always. 615. 620 at 55 KRC, the talk station. I guess today is the day the bars and restaurants are now open full capacity, according to Governor Beshear's most recent sphincter-inspired COVID-19 dine-safe order, filled with contradictions it is. But before we get to that, let's go over to the phones to see what folks got this morning. Talking about Louisville, of course, riots and protests. Two officers got shot. And, of course, a lot of questions swirling around. No charges at all in connection with, this is what Will brought up, nothing in connection with Breonna Taylor's death. And I certainly understand why someone might be upset about that. She was completely innocent. She had nothing to do with anything. She ended up getting shot six times in this altercation. So I get that. But you got to go to the law and see what the law says, and you have to have a grand jury at least believe there's probable cause to believe that crime has been committed and hand out indictments and charges. And that clearly didn't happen here. So I share people's concerns over what the grand jury got to see. I know the grand jury proceedings are held in private. They don't always give out the information, but quite often they will. And to sort of satisfy a information-hungry public, certain details would be very important and I think go a long way to explaining why she didn't get or why no one was indicted in connection with her death, or perhaps answer more or raise more questions along those same lines. Well, wait a minute. Look at this. You didn't provide this evidence. You had evidence that this happened, and yet you didn't let the grand jury know. That kind of thing. The prosecutor is completely and exclusively in charge of what information the grand jurors receive, as much or as little as he or she wants them to see. So that information, I believe, is important for us. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program, and a very happy Thursday to you.
Hey, Brian. Happy Thursday.
Thanks.
One thing about it, too, I wish the news, all these news outlets need to come out and explain to people what the grand jury is, who is on it. They don't, a lot of people think, oh, these people were elected. Like, no, they're just a regular juror.
Yeah.
It's just random people. They could be black, white, green, purple. We don't know.
That is correct.
And that's the one thing a lot of people don't understand what the grand jury is. Some people think it's a high, like a court.
Like
thing,
a star chamber.
Not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a bunch of elected officials sitting back harumphing over legal evidence. No, if you can get a jury request form. Yeah. Summons. Right. Show up. You're going to serve on the grand jury. It's just like they ask you to come down to court and serve on the regular courts and criminal system and the civil system.
Right. It's just like a regular jury. The judge tells them, this is, look at the facts.
Yeah.
Yes, someone died, but you can't look at it that way. You have to look at the facts.
That is correct. And
you don't know, they could have been all black people on that jury. Could have been
you know, I was
know.
Just thinking along those lines. Now, they don't let people know who the specific grand jurors are. And I think that's honestly a decent thing, only because with doxing and internet and the violence and anger that people will unleash on otherwise very innocent people who have nothing to do with anything. That concerns me. But yeah, if they could come out and say, well, just for your information, you think this was a racially biased jury or something, you know, it had four Hispanic people on it. There were four people that were black. There were four people that were, you know, white suburban housewives, or half of them were women. You know, you could provide that baseline information. I think that would satisfy some. It would at least provide a little bit of insight that it wasn't just, you know, I guess what people might expect out there, a bunch of 50-year-old white men. So thanks, man. Good to hear from you. See what Dave's got this morning. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Morning. Thank you. Like you, I think we don't have enough evidence. I don't think we're even close to having enough evidence. In fact, I think we got almost zero evidence here. In fact, this stinks so badly to me that the whole thing seems like a setup. Something's rotten in Denmark. I think the boyfriend needs to be investigated. Each cop individually needs to be investigated. The department needs to be investigated to see if there's any kind of connection that would set this up so that an unarmed woman who isn't shooting at the police, who is near an armed man who is shooting at the police, gets all the rounds in her body.
Yeah. Oh, I would love to know the trajectory of all of the bullets. And I know they got it. They went in there and did forensic analysis. You know, you got, I just see in my mind's eye a doorway, right? And you walk in and there's a couch there, and that's where Brianna and her boyfriend are or whatever. But then how in the hell do bullets end up in the neighboring apartments, plural? I just have this impression of this officer that got indicted, Officer Hankinson, just sort of, you know, just shooting around, just bang, 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 just, you know, waving his gun around, firing off rounds. And, you know, with a wanton endangerment charge, you might easily conclude that. But we don't know, do we, Dave? Because the grand jury information is kept quiet until, of course, they decide to release it, if they do. Keeping people in the dark, Dave thinks there's a conspiracy behind that. Not sure. It is 6:30 right now, 55 Care City Talk Station. Hope you're having a decent Thursday. Put a smile on your face, because FOP President, Cincinnati Police Department, Chapter 69, is on the phone. Of course, his name is Dan Hills. Dan, welcome back, my friend. It's always great talking with you.
Hey, it's always great being here with your audience, Brian.
Hey, not like we don't have anything to talk about. Hey, what's going on in your world, Dan, huh?
there's not a thing. It's quite slow, right?
Right.
We're just having we're just having riots around, what, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, I don't know.
It seems to be perpetual. I just kind of throw it into the number of days, actually. We've had these things going on now for like 4 months. In any event, we'll get to Louisville momentarily. Let's start right off. Of course, I think the predicate for this needs to be that the city of Cincinnati seems to be broke. They had to borrow and therefore pay debt service $50 million to close the budget gap this year, and I thought that was rather interesting, particularly given that you're going to hit them up for some raises for our fine Cincinnati Police Department. So the union's going to go for some more money. How much, and do you think you're going to be met with opposition, or in these terrible, troubled times where we're having a difficult time with police morale and maintaining police numbers, will they go ahead and give you the money you think you deserve?
Well, obviously, Brian, we're not going to talk about percentages or anything. The word I use is significant, significant pay raises. We proved once again to be the best police department in the country as we went through the civil unrest / riots, whatever it is, terminology you like to put towards what it was that happened here in Cincinnati. But as bad as it was, and it was obviously very bad, very dangerous, very scary for the men and women and their families who have to see them leave for their 12-hour shifts and not know what they're going to be facing and the danger they're going to be facing. Yeah. As bad as it was, you know, police officers shot in the head and everything, it was so much better here than in other places. And why was that? It was, I have a simple answer. It's because of the men and women of the Cincinnati Police Department. Their training, their ability, the quality of men and women that they have found for these positions. I mean, these folks knocked it out of the park, and they were able to maintain the peace. And still, no deadly force used by Cincinnati Police this year going through these situations. Unbelievable. So no matter how much the city has in debt, it would be worse if they did not have the men and women of the Cincinnati Police Department. No matter how bad the economy has been roughed up, it'd be way, way worse if it wasn't for the quality of people that they have in the Cincinnati Police Department. An investment in our police is an investment in our city. So they better make that investment. They have no choice but to make that investment. They cannot let these folks move on to other places, although many of them are considering moving on to stuff completely beyond law enforcement because right. The way law enforcement officers are being treated. I think this is something the citizens will decide. The citizens will decide that council, I might vote Democratic most of the time or whatever. Not talking about me, obviously, but the people out there might feel that way. But this time in our city, we need to support law enforcement.
Well, and the vast majority of folks out, I think, generally speaking, do. And this is a numbers game being played on the internet, where the internet can make 5 people sound like a crowd of 5,000. So percentage-wise, plus when you have people protesting and rioting in the streets, although there's a lot of indication that those folks are making the rounds going from city to city. So the numbers, again, appear much greater in those opposing the police department and demanding defunding than I believe they actually are. But the question is this... I don't believe most people will make an argument that the police department is not worthy of a raise. Almost look at it like, well, hazard pay situations. You know, some people are paid more because they have hazards to deal with, so I get that. But will the budget itself, the problem with lack of money coming in, the COVID-19, which is exacerbated because Governor DeWine wanted to shut down all the bars and restaurants and unnecessary stores. People aren't working in downtown Cincinnati as much, so the earnings tax isn't going to be coming in. They got serious financial problems. Can they, given that, still provide the officers with the raise you think you're looking for?
I don't think they cannot. I really do. Could you imagine? Once again, if they started to lose the quality that they have here, what would happen to the economy then if the crime got worse, if the unrest got worse? All those things are being held in check by the Cincinnati police officers. I think if they look at the books and look a little deeper, they're going to have to realize they absolutely have no choice because, again— we have jail overcrowding problems. We have prison overcrowding problems. We have huge societal problems. Basically, they hit the jackpot in the agency that they have, the training that it provides, and the people that they've recruited. They cannot lose them. And I tell you, if they do not show up and find a way, and, you know, I'm not a budget expert, I'm not a finance expert. If they don't find a way to keep and retain these folks, the city will suffer, and it will suffer greatly. So it's not a matter of can they. They have to realize that they absolutely have to.
Right.
They have to find a way to show their appreciation, to retain these folks. And I know it's going to be difficult. I know it's tough in the budget right now, but they're between the ultimate rock and a hard place.
Well, and that suggests, and you can put an exclamation point on if you want to, FOP President Dan Hills, that suggests that the numbers of officers who are contemplating early retirement or just outright leaving law enforcement or moving to maybe quieter jurisdictions in smaller towns, there's a substantial number of those. Is that what you're saying?
Without a doubt. And okay. And I'm here to tell you, and I'm gonna steal a little bit from Sheriff Jim Neal. We had a press conference in support of Steve Shabbat, and Jim Neal was talking about losing qualified immunity and what it would do to law enforcement.
I think
it would be the end, as he termed it. He said it would end it as a profession, and it would leave it as just a job. You would get people that would come and go and take it as a job, and it would no longer be a profession. And I think Cincinnati faces the same thing here. There was one of their problems is we know, or they know, you know, it wasn't me. My better years are beyond me, but they know exactly how well they performed, and they know the stress, and their family knows the stress they went through. So if the city doesn't find a way to show their appreciation for the men and women of the Cincinnati Police Department, yes, it will be felt, and people will make different career choices, and not only the ones that are here now, but the ones that have an option of choosing another career field or another department. It's at a breaking point, but the city has an ability to do something about it. It's going to be tough for them, but that's. I'm sorry, that's their problem.
Get out ahead of it before it becomes a catastrophe, says Dan Hills. Don't go away, Dan. We got more to talk about, including is yesterday's non-vote. It is 6:42. 55 Cares City Talk Station. Brian Thomas here with FOP President Dan Hills. Asking for raises. He is. We've been through that. Now, what was your perception of yesterday's vote on the defund police motion? Betsy Sunderman's going to be on in the next hour at this time to talk about it. But her motion stating the council, is not going to defund the police. Short, sweet, and to the point. Sittenfeld wanted to add a paragraph to the bottom of the motion stating the council also supports the Black Lives Matter movement. And Seelbach wanted to change the word defund to abolish, suggesting that he perhaps does want to make budget cuts. So I don't think you have a friend in Chris Seelbach. Dan Hills, they didn't vote on it. Council voted 5-4 against even taking it up. So
it got torn apart, and you know, while it was very, very important to find out where people stood, you know, it did have, a symbolistic traits to it. So,
yeah.
Let's talk about what I was talking about earlier and talk about kind of a general politics thing here in Hamilton County. You know, the last election, Republicans got rocked a bit and found out that, yeah, Hamilton County is blue. And, but I have this belief, and I think we'll see it in the sheriff's race. I think we'll see it in the prosecutor's race. And I think it's even going to find its way into the mayor's race, that Cincinnati, Hamilton County may be blue, but it's not leftist wacko blue.
Right.
And I think P.G. Sittenfeld, who really wants to be the mayor really badly, should take notice and listen. That even though folks in Cincinnati may be more Democrats, some of them may even be liberal, you know, you have large swaths of voters in Hyde Park and Oakley. These folks love their police officers. The West Side love their police officers. And when PG wants to take something that was meant to show support for the men and women that are out on the streets, who are risking their lives every day and night, and tag on a leftist, I even believe anarchist, a group to that. I think he's exposing himself, and I think it's something that he is going to feel in his quest to be our mayor. And as far as Seelbach, I mean, that guy's just always been off the charts. Yeah, he'd like to defund the police. Heck, the word he wants to put in there, abolish, I wouldn't be surprised if he'd like to abolish the police, because he's that far off the reservation.
He struggles. He struggles to remain relevant.
Yes, he does. And so, you know, Betsy, I wasn't there. I had some ushers I had to represent, and wasn't able to make it there. I understand it became a bit of a blank show anyway. And so therefore I don't want to give them further ammunition
right.
to take part in it. But, it was great, because I think it exposes who, PG Sittenfeld is. And I think that's something the voters need to know. People are changing their minds. Like I said, even people who normally vote Democratic, Jim Neal is a Democrat, Dusty Rhodes is a Democrat, but that's more of the style of the Cincinnati Hamilton County type of Democrat. Where these folks are going, that's not Hamilton County, and that's not the city of Cincinnati.
At least for the time being, and I can only hope that it does stay that way. FOP President Dan Hales, don't go away. I want to get your thoughts and impressions about Louisville after I mention my friends over at Honey Sweetie Acres. 651, 55 Care CD Talk Station, and happy Thursday to you. Coming up, Chris Whipple, author of Spy Masters, and Betsy Sunderman in the next hour as well, to talk about that motion that got shot down in flames. In the meantime, talking with law enforcement here, FOP President Dan Hills. Dan, your reaction to Louisville? Obviously, protesters and rioters taken to the streets because they didn't get what they wanted, which I believe was the head of three police officers. Wanton endangerment. One officer, Hankinson is his last name. He's been relieved of command or relieved of duty right after this shooting. He's basically indicted for recklessly shooting or wantonly shooting his gun into some other neighbor's apartments. I don't know how that happened. We're short on details on that. But your reaction, to the extent you've got a conclusion to reach there, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I'm short on some of the facts, but to what I could tell, and, you know, you saw the Attorney General in Kentucky trying to explain the process and the law. I know that the country only stands and only survives with the rule of law. And you may not like the laws as they are written. If so, then change the lawmakers. You know, you might not like the way the rules of law are delivered. Then change who the prosecutor is. Or in my case, you know, locally here, I like who the prosecutor is, and I know who I want to be the sheriff. It becomes very political. And what I fear as we go forward and mob rule supersedes the rule of law, people will vote with their feet and they'll vote with their pocketbooks.
Yeah.
They will not stay in a community that can erupt at any minute. It just doesn't make any common sense. And they will not come and spend their money where they don't feel safe and things could erupt at any minute. So if you don't like the rule of law, then go to the ballot and vote. My guess is that, and it's a pretty fair guess, is that the grand jury in Kentucky applied the law the way they saw, and they did not see violations for two of the three officers. Remember, there was a police officer shot in this deal. And there was some connection to people who dealt drugs. I don't know, you know, if she was involved. There are people all over the internet saying all sorts of things.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't there, and I don't have all the facts that the law enforcement or the prosecutor's office has. But I know that nobody had more facts than this grand jury, and they applied the law as citizens. Brought forth to serve their duty as jurors, and they applied the law the best they could. And after that, if it's not accepted, then like I said, change the lawmakers, change the prosecutors, change the attorney general, do what you can. But mob rule is unacceptable, even though I say that, because it has become acceptable for some folks in some regions. And you're going to find that a whole lot of people that see it as ridiculous are going to vote with their feet and their pocketbooks and leave a lot more suffering. So this is critical time for our country.
Without a doubt. I guess I've asked that the grand jury information come out. I know Governor Beshear asked for it just to give us all a sense of understanding of perhaps why there were no indictments. I mean, come on, fair enough. So we'll see if we do get more information. It's difficult for me to speculate on things that I have no information about. Like, for example, whether or not she was involved in any drug issues. I know there were no reports that they found any contraband or drugs in the apartment. And I certainly understand the idea if someone kicks in your door in the middle of the night unannounced, although now there's evidence and testimony that there was a knock first, but go kicking in someone's door. Yeah, go get kicking in somebody's door in the middle of the night, though, Dan, and you don't have a uniform on. I certainly would think that you would believe yourself going in as a police officer. You run the risk of getting shot. I mean, if it was your house, Dan, you know, someone kicks the door in.
We don't know what that grand jury knows.
Right.
And that's why, again, you have to have some faith in the law. And, again, let's say that the worst that you can imagine in this is true. Again, we are talking about the most isolated of incidents, and I don't think that's the case. But if you think the worst of the police in all this, if we're still talking about the most isolated of incidents that occur across this country, 121 homicides were recorded in Louisville, I think, when they had four last weekend or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It's their all-time record. It's September. And we don't hear anything about that. Yeah. Why don't you hear anything about that?
Because it's bad news. It goes in the police's column in terms of why they're so important and valuable. Violence on the rise, shootings on the rise. We need more police. It flies against the narrative. Dan, always a pleasure having you on. I hope you stay well, and best of luck on your negotiations with the city and for on getting raises. When do they start? Real quick, when do you start?
We're meeting as a wage team real soon here, and we've given notice to the city that we'd like to have a chit-chat.
Yes, that was loud and clear. Dan, take care, my friend. We'll talk to you real soon. Folks, stick around. Got Betsy Sunderman coming up in the next hour, and also author Chris Whipple, Spy Masters. Be right back.
It's the stuff.
It's just insane around the country what's going on.
People are talking about.
I mean, what happened to law and order?
55 KRSE, the talk station.
It's 7:06 at 55 KRSE, the talk station. Friday Eve. Phone number here is 749-5500, 800-823-TALK, #550 on AT&T phones. Want to comment on something going on in the world? I know they heard a lot about Louisville today, and always interesting to get people's perceptions of this. And I don't think any of us have enough information because we don't know what the grand jury heard to know whether or not they were provided with a complete picture. A lot of questions about where those bullets flew. How come Breonna Taylor got shot six times and her boyfriend, who was the one who opened fire on the police executing that warrant, didn't get a gunshot wound? He originally was charged with attempted murder of a police officer because one of the officers got shot, and then those charges were dropped. Again, go back to the idea you kick somebody's door in the middle of the night, they may very well be a gun owner. You know, we have certain rights, and we have the perception that grievous bodily harm may befall us if we don't act to defend ourselves. And I can certainly understand the position of Breonna Taylor's boyfriend opening fire when these people just kick the door in and apparently weren't wearing uniforms. That's the biggest part for me. Not wearing uniforms. Some outward, easily and quickly acknowledgeable sign of authority figure. In other words, no, it's not a burglar breaking in. It's not someone who wants to do you harm or take all your belongings and your life from you. It's, oh, look, it's a uniformed police officer serving a warrant. Maybe I better not open fire. Anyway, never had to be in a situation like that. Don't want to be in a situation like that. But here's the aftermath. And, of course, Louisville is, and metaphorically and perhaps actually burning now. Over to the phones we go. I got Bob on the phone here. Hey, Bob, long time no speak. Welcome back to the 55 KRC Morning Show.
Well, I listen all the time, usually something doesn't raise my hackles except this atrocious development last night in Louisville.
All right, do tell.
I had it one time about four and a half years ago, three good friends that were in law enforcement I have none now.
Mm.
And this is, these were good men and women. There was one woman in there. And they said, look, I'm not putting my life online because administrations can't pull their head out of their sphincter.
Yeah.
And see what's developing and building. And it almost seems like it's been unproclaimed to develop a civil unrest. Now, you have to ask yourself for what reason and what is going to be the response to it.
Well, one can speculate all day long, but I think it's suffice to say, and it's something I mentioned in the 5 o'clock hour this morning, there is a growing, it seems, at least the internet provides you an insight more so than before internet, growing group of people who obviously want to do America harm and undermine America completely. Maybe they're communists or socialists or Marxists. Maybe they're just foreign powers like China and Russia. George Soros would like to, you know, globalize the entire world and put it all under one controlled umbrella. You can't do that with the United States standing as a representative of everything that can be accomplished when we have a free society. So maybe crack down on freedom. Maybe divide us among different groups.
They can attempt it.
I know they can attempt it.
They may attempt, but this is going to fall flat, and it's going to leave the local authorities, and sad to say, my friends that were once law enforcement hanging on out to dry.
Well, and that's what
I don't like that.
I don't know if you heard Dan Hill speak earlier. That's, I think, what he was alluding to when he said, you know, we're going to get raises, or I'm asking for raises, because if you don't, you're not going to be able to retain the police department. Everybody's looking for a different job, or at least to move out of a higher density population urban area to some maybe perhaps quiet rural or quiet rural town, right, Bob?
Well, they're going to go to personal protection groups.
Oh, yeah, militias?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, groups as far as a small area hiring their own security forces.
Or organizing by neighborhoods to look out for each other, and obviously that may involve carrying and practicing with firearms, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, everybody who owns a firearm, me included, knows that the police are minutes away if you're calling 911, and those minutes ticking away are going to seem like hours if you have an intruder in your home. So,
right, exactly.
Yeah, better off being able to take care of yourself. And doesn't the government even recommend that, Bob? Stocking in several days at least worth of food, being prepared, having a water supply, because you never know when the lights are going to go out or your neighborhood's going to be attacked. Our own government.
That's it, exactly.
Bob, always good hearing from you. Stay well, my friend.
I keep listening.
I appreciate it.
You know, you come on the line, I'm there listening.
So happy to hear it, Bob. Looking forward to talking to you again soon.
You have a good day now.
You too. Let's go to Stuart. Welcome to the morning show, and a very happy Thursday to you, Stuart.
And you as well. I want to change the subject on you, get back to the one that we've all loved over the last six, 7 months.
Go ahead.
I dropped you an email about Indiana going to level 5, which is full open for the coronavirus.
Oh, and look what I've got in front of me. Governor DeWine's Dine Safe Order, which opens bars and restaurants today, or restaurants at least, full capacity beginning this morning at 12:01.
Amazing how these politicians work. Opens in one, opens in another. Got to make sure that we cover our local bases, right?
Well, what are the bars and restaurant owners been complaining about? Kentucky's open until midnight. Indiana's open. Everybody's going to go over there if they're close enough to go there. You're killing our business.
Exactly.
Heck, I had a Grubhub owner on yesterday, the Grubhub, rather. He got a citation because they apparently had served someone alcohol. Oh, my God. Heaven forbid, after 10 o'clock.
Need revenue.
You know
need
it.
Revenue.
You know it, man. So take care, Stuart. Appreciate you bringing that one to everybody's attention. Yes, I've already, in the 5 o'clock hour, rather, I love looking at the insane contradictions on this. Bobby, hold on 1 second. I'm getting your call on this segment. But the Dine Safe Ohio order, and I'm looking at the fact sheet from the government. Barriers recommended for restaurants and bars. What type? It is recommended that barriers be placed between booths or tables, be smooth, easily cleanable, non-porous, properly clean between dining parties, and comply with building and fire department regulations. Shower curtains may be used if they meet these stipulations and are approved by the building and or fire department. So you have to work through the administration on this one. I love this. Barriers made of fabric, cloth, or other porous materials are not permitted. This, after they've told us countless times, you better have a mask on, all of which are fabric, so you don't spread coronavirus. But no, it doesn't work as a curtain, but it works on your face. Right. Only one of a multitude of seeming contradictions in this revised order here, but thankfully at least they're open to full capacity now in Ohio. Bobby, thanks for calling. Welcome to the program.
Yes, Brian. I want to talk to you about the Louisville situation.
Yep.
I was traveling through Louisville yesterday and was listening to a local station when all this stuff came out. And one of the local reporters commented that the officer that was charged was at a rear door. And the trajectory of his fire sent the bullets into the neighboring apartment.
Yeah.
Daniel Cameron also did a press conference yesterday afternoon, and he gave out a tremendous amount of information about this and painted a picture for me that I had not heard anywhere in the media. Maybe you can look that up on YouTube or look at his transcripts from that. Also, last night was listening to Fox News, and Judge Napolitano commented that A.G. Cameron had given out all the information that he could give without a judge's order.
Right.
To disseminate more information because it would pollute the case.
Right.
So, but I thought he painted a tremendous picture of what had happened and that there were actually, this was not just a lone warrant. There were three or four warrants that were issued that, and the three officers involved in this shooting had not obtained the warrants. They were called in to serve it because they wanted to serve all these warrants together to get all the evidence without stuff being flushed and people being warned.
Right.
To bring down this one ring.
Right, so that is accurate from based upon what I read. There's a separate officer that was identified in the reporting that obtained the warrant. And he's the guy, obviously, that went before the judge and said, here's all the probable cause information. The judge reads it and says, yeah, there's probable cause to believe a crime has been committed or this guy is there or whatever. And that's how they go and serve it. I have been led to believe, and perhaps it's wrong, but these officers weren't in uniform, and that presents to me. I think it's ridiculous that an officer wouldn't be in uniform, otherwise identifying himself appropriately for the reasons we've been talking about. Someone might think you're a burglar and open fire on you. So
yes, he also mentioned. I heard reports that she was in bed, and he, Attorney General Cameron mentioned that she was in the hallway with her boyfriend,
okay,
who opened fire on the police, and you know whether he hit the ground or whatever, but she took the stray bullets that were going in that direction.
Yeah,
and
six of them. I mean, that's the other thing. Yeah. I want to see the ballistics evidence on this, where these bullets went relative to where the officers pulling the trigger were standing, because the boyfriend with the gun who opened fire didn't suffer any injuries. She got six of them. See, and that's the kind of thing that really agitates folks. And you're like, well, this is impossible. How could someone not be charged? Well, we don't know all of the information. So I share Governor Beshear's request and argument that the grand jury information should be made available. And whatever judge you need to go to release it should be gone to, and with a motion asking that it be released so the public can be satisfied or at least have some knowledge or insight into how much or how little the grand jury was provided by way of evidence. I think it would solve a lot of our outstanding questions. Bobby, great hearing from you today. Thanks. 717, I got Joe on the phone. 721, 55 KRCD Talk Station. Going to make this a short segment. We'll get to Joe, who's on the phone right away. Joe, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Brian. God bless you and the Thomas family.
Oh, thank you very much. It's kind of
you. You're welcome. Maybe I'm behind on the curve here, but has anybody suggested that we defund the politicians?
Oh, Joe, I love you, man. Oh, my God. Yes, please. That should become a nationwide, all-out, non-party affiliation effort. Yeah. Do you think they have a bit of a spending problem, Joe?
Just a little bit.
Golly.
It's like a chronic gambler type thing going on.
It really is. They all need to seek some counseling. Thanks for that one, Joe.
Sure.
Put a smile on my face today. God bless you. 722, we're going to go take an early break because coming up, Chris Whipple. Who is Chris? He's the author of The Spy Masters, How CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. He had access to all the living former CIA directors. Should be a fascinating book. We'll talk with Chris. 7:26 right now, 55KRCD Talk Station. Back early, of course. Got Chris Whipple on the line. We're going to be talking to Chris momentarily. He's in the middle of wrapping up another interview about his amazing book, Spy Masters, which is going to be a really fascinating read. I'm very confident. Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. Real quick here, in terms of contradictions, I want to give you one more. It's in this Governor DeWine revised order saying that the restaurants can now go back to full capacity beginning this morning at 12:01. How about self-service items like condiment stations and bulk donut cases? Those are forbidden. So are roller grill stations, you know, with your wieners on them. Soft-serve ice cream and yogurt machines are forbidden. Bulk food dispensers and self-service stations that allow customers to help themselves free product samples. So you're not getting free samples at Costco. Salad bars and buffets are permitted only if served by staff within 6 feet of social distancing between parties. I was just kind of wondering how do you do a self-serve salad bar when the staff has to go get it for you. Anyway, this is the contradiction, though. Self-service beverages are permitted. Now, if you're allowed to get a self-service beverage, is there any difference between getting a self-service beverage and a self-service ice cream? No, the machines both operate the same way, don't they? Okay, great. Well, that's not the only contradiction, but congratulations, bars and restaurants. I guess restaurants are now back open to full capacity. So without further ado, welcome to the 55KRC Morning Show. Chris Whipple, author of The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. Obviously, everybody's seen you all over television, probably read your prior book, which called The Gatekeepers. And I know Amazon named that one of the best books of the year. Chris Whipple, welcome to the 55KRC Morning Show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Now, as it's pointed out in the notes, there are roughly 11 former heads of the CIA that are still alive. How were you able to get access to and talk with all but, I guess, one of them, Chris? That's a tall order in and of itself.
Well, it was, it wasn't easy. One at a time is the short answer. when you talk to every living CIA director, which I did starting back in 2015, I spoke to all of them up through John Brennan. One of the first things you learn is just how significant that job is. And the CIA director is the person we depend on to prevent another Pearl Harbor, 9/11, or a lethal pandemic. And it's almost an impossible balancing act, too, because you've got to be able to tell the president hard truths, and at the same time, you've got to have his ear. If you don't have a seat at the table, you can't be effective as CIA director, and that's tough in the best of times. It's almost impossible with the current president, as you can imagine.
Well, you brought the pandemic up, and I guess I'm glad on some level you did. I didn't realize the CIA was charged with, protecting us from the pandemic. So I guess if we're going to be blaming someone for it coming here or not having full knowledge and an understanding about how it works or how many people are at risk, should we be blaming the CIA then, Chris?
Well, you know, that happens a lot, as you can probably imagine. One former director told me that, you know, Chris, we'll always have a CIA. It's never going to be abolished because if not for the CIA, whom would the president blame? So they often take the blame. In this case, I have a whole chapter about Trump and his two CIA heads, Mike Pompeo and Gina Haspel, and also an epilogue on the pandemic and what the president knew and when he knew it and what the intelligence community told him. And the truth is that the president's daily brief had warnings of the pandemic throughout January. Trump, of course, insisted that he hadn't heard about it until January 23, and then he threw his CIA briefer under the bus by saying, "She told me it was no big deal." Well, everything in the president's daily brief is a big deal. And when you're briefed verbally about it, too, as he was, it's an even bigger deal. So that doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Is that because, I suppose, in the entire world, and the CIA's got its tentacles out there in the entire world, that there are a whole host of threats? Some are more important than others, but there's no way that a president could be up on top of every single threat that's out there. So what, you boil them down, you decide which ones are the worst, and then you put that in the daily briefing and let them know about it?
Yeah, that's right. So the president's daily brief, or PDB, as it's called, goes all the way back almost to John F. Kennedy. It's a very brief, as the title implies, summary of the stuff that the president absolutely needs to know. And one of the problems we have now is we have a president who doesn't read the PDB. He is incurious. He's convinced that he knows everything he needs to know. And he brought a real contempt for the intelligence community into office, as we all know. He compared them to Nazi Germany. By the way, it's not the first time, and this is where I think my book comes in. It's not the first time that a president has thought that the CIA was some kind of deep state full of liberals who are trying to hell-bent on bringing him down. That's what Richard Nixon thought about the CIA and its director, Richard Helms. And they're both wrong. Nixon was wrong. Trump is wrong. They're mostly people who are just trying to do their job and ignore whoever's in the Oval Office.
But that's not to say it's completely devoid of politics. I mean, we learned that about our FBI and the Department of Justice because, you know, when you're relying on shaky evidence and lying to FISA courts, you've got a problem on your hands internally.
Well, look, you know, it's these agencies are full of human beings.
Right.
Nobody ever said that they were perfect. Everybody's got their political point of view, and you do, and I do. And so that's just a given. But once again, I mean, there's no evidence that there was any political prejudice behind the investigations into Russia, for example. Sure, there was misconduct at fairly low levels, frankly.
That's where you get the subpoenas, or that's where you get the FISA warrants. It's an awfully listen. As a lawyer, and I am, the lack of due process in FISA courts. We probably talk for hours on that.
Have there been screw ups? Yeah,
Have
been screw ups.
That's the
but
concern.
What I'm here to tell you, having looked at this over the last 70 years, from Richard Helms to Gina Haspel, is that these people, almost to a person, are just trying to do their job honestly and present honest intelligence to the president and to, the national security staff around him. And all too often, they get blamed for stuff that presidents ask them to do.
Bay of Pigs?
I've got a lot of great stories about that.
Like Bay of Pigs?
Throughout the history of the CIA.
Like the Bay of Pigs, Chris, I guess, because that was an epic fail on the part of at least the CIA got blamed for that one. Is that Kennedy's fault?
That was an epic fail.
Yeah.
That one was not Kennedy's fault. But Eisenhower, it was certainly organized under his predecessor, Eisenhower. And Kennedy, stupidly, gave it the green light. There's no question about it.
Yeah. Ever since then, they've been...
That was one of the great fiascos. And another one, of course, was WMDs. And I have two chapters on George Tenet, who was a fascinating character.
I imagine. And how is it... You know, and I suppose we have to take your word for it, the word for it of the former CIA directors, which are all in your book, The Spy Masters, How the CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. The CIA, by its design, is cloaked in secrecy. I had a college professor in undergrad who jokingly said, you know, if you ever meet somebody from the State Department when you're in D.C., you're probably talking to a CIA agent. They don't go around telling you that they're at Langley, but they will go out and around say that they're from the State Department. Many people in the State Department out in the world are working and reporting back to the CIA, so they work hand in hand. But it's all cloaked in secrecy. So,
yes and no, because it certainly was true in the early days, but since the mid-70s, after all of those huge scandals of CIA skullduggery all over the world and attempted assassination plots, you remember, you may or may not be old enough to remember all this, but the family jewels that were revealed since those days, there's now really pretty ironclad congressional oversight. And to give you an example, every covert operation, anything of any significance, has to be briefed to Congress and the so-called Gang of Eight, the congressional leaders. And that's really changed the game dramatically since the 70s.
Well, and that's actually a positive development. Think about it. There are eight, and presumably both parties participate in that. And it takes complete isolation and authority from one man, the President of the United States of America, I suppose, giving it an extra set of eyes so cooler heads and better decisions can be made, Chris?
Yeah. And one of the great stories I tell in the book, which I don't think anybody was aware of at the time, is that before the Bin Laden operation took place, Leon Panetta was the CIA director at that point, and he went over to Capitol Hill and he briefed congressional leaders on it. And when Barack Obama and his chief of staff, Bill Daley, got wind of this, they went ballistic. Bill Daley picked up the phone, called Panetta, chewed him out. He said he was sure he's going to pick up the Washington Post the next day and there'd be a headline saying, U.S. is about to strike bin Laden. And Panetta said, basically said, look, guys, tough luck. That's my job. That's my duty. And if this thing goes south, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have Congress at least having been informed, and they're going to be invested in it more than they would have if they're blindsided. And tough luck. And that's those are the kinds of calls you have to make as CIA director.
Yes, indeed. And real quick, final question. I'm just wildly curious about this. You talk to all the CIA directors. They are obviously privy to a lot of secrets and information that the government will not allow out. How long did it take you to get the book approved by whatever agency reviews books before publication, Chris?
Well, here's a surprise for you. Nobody had to approve it.
Really?
And that's the big advantage. You know, the CIA directors have to go through a gauntlet, a review board that scrubs everything they write. But as a journalist, I don't have to go through that process. So what you see, and there's nobody sitting in the room with Leon Panetta or George Tenet telling them what they can say or not say. So I hope people will pick up the book and be surprised by a lot of the stuff that they told me.
Chris Whipple, real pleasure talking to you. The name of the book, The Spy Masters, How CIA Directors Shape History and the Future. It's on my blog page, Chris. My listeners know to go to 55krc.com. Click on it, buy a copy, enjoy it. Fascinating insight with access to some of the, well, some of the people you don't often hear from. Chris, real pleasure. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
7:38 right now. We're going to hear from Betsy. 7:41 right now at 55KRC, the talk station, and a very happy Friday Eve to you. Joe's busy trying to get Betsy Sunderman on the phone. Talked to her about her failed motion yesterday, but happy to see Governor DeWine, I suppose, maybe for a number of reasons. We had our local bar owner, who I had on the program yesterday, Grub Pub owner Patrick Kane, and he got cited and has to appear before the Ohio Liquor Commission because somebody at their bar served someone alcohol after 10. And talk with him about what he's going to have to do. He's going to go for the Ohio Liquor Control Commission. My point to him was, listen, if the governor doesn't have the authority to single out you, your business, and when it is you serve customers, and I don't believe he does, then the predicate for the violation and the reason you're in front of the Ohio Liquor Control Commission is because you're acting and operating under an order that has no strength. So try to get out of it. And then lo and behold, today I wake up and see that as of 12:01, bars and restaurants specifically are allowed to be open to full capacity. And it's weird because they do mention liquor one time in this, and it's just talking about when you're being served food or alcohol or anything, you can take the mask off in order to consume it. Gee, great. Got to be sitting down to consume and eat as well. But it doesn't say anything about lifting the 10 o'clock cutoff. We'll see if we can't get the answer to that. In the meantime, Betsy Sunderman returns to the 55KRC Morning Show. Councilwoman Sunderman, it's always good to talk with you. How are you today?
We have so much to discuss today.
We do. We do. Let's start with, first off, I discussed with Dan Hills this morning, FOP President Dan Hills, the raises that they're going to be requesting. As a matter of procedure, I guess, one, I'm going to wonder whether or not you'd be in support of giving the police officers more money. But do the individual council members have a say on this? If the city manager and the police negotiate a raise or some accommodation that's, you know, collective bargaining agreement, does the city council have to vote on that?
We have to approve the final collective bargaining agreement,
okay,
which would include steps for raises and things like that.
Okay.
I have not talked to Mr. Hills about his request for more money. When different police officers have asked me about it, I tell them, hey, I'm just trying not to get you defunded. So, I mean, getting a raise is not even on the table for me. I'm just trying to keep them fully funded as they are now.
Understood. And that was the purpose of your motion yesterday. His concern and his point is, it is almost like a line in the sand for Dan. He was very adamant about this. If we don't get a raise, we will not really have much of a police department. A lot of officers, and he said it was a lot, grumbling about retirement, moving on to different professions, moving out of our area in pursuit of a law enforcement job, perhaps that's carries less risk, you know, perhaps a more rural climb. That's the reason, and that's the motivation. And he suggests without additional pay, we're going to have a problem with keeping law enforcement officers, Betsy.
Absolutely. I mean, officers can retire in a range of years. So a lot of them hang on longer so they can make a little more money. But I think they're leaning toward retiring a little earlier now. If they're not going to get raises, if they're not going to get any support from their employers, from the city, if they're going to be the most hated people, they're even more hated than us lawyers now, which is unbelievable.
I know. I'm a recovering lawyer, though, Betsy, so don't hate me as much. Well, I get that. I hear it, although I don't think there's really, on a percentage of population basis, that many people who really hate the law enforcement officers, really believe there's some sort of systemic racism or misconduct built into at least the Cincinnati Police Department. Other police departments, I think, may have a tougher row to hoe. They haven't demonstrated.
Right. But I've talked to police officers, Cincinnati police officers, who say, oh, my kids are wrapped up in this anti-police movement. My own children now are saying they don't think I should do my job anymore, and they don't believe in our profession. I'm like, oh, gosh.
Pull them out of school. Take them off of social media. Jiminy Christmas. They're getting brainwashed, Betsy. Pause for a moment.
My kids have been out of school. I'm trying to get them back in school.
No, I'm talking about any law enforcement, any member of law enforcement who's got a child out there who's gone all Antifa. We got a problem on our hands. Betsy, don't go away, because that'll set us up nicely for the motion that you brought up yesterday that, well, thanks to, looks like PG's sitting. Coming up on 751 right now, 55 Care City Talk Station. We're going to be hearing from Mark Burgess, CEO of Disabled American Veterans. We're celebrating their 100th anniversary after the top of the hour news, followed by our aviation expert, Jay Ratliff, at 8:30. In the meantime, Betsy Sunderman from Cincinnati City Council is on. And she had a motion she teed up yesterday. City of Cincinnati Council, or City Council, does not support the movement to defend the Cincinnati Police Department. Short and sweet, an expression of the will of council. Betsy, it didn't go that way. What happened yesterday?
Well, to back up a little bit, my original motion that went through the committee was to instruct the city manager that when we go through the collective bargaining agreement with the police, that we not try to defund them as part of the collective bargaining agreement, which will have to be completed in May of next year. So when that went through committee, my colleagues said, we don't want it to say that. Can you change it to... we don't support the movement to defund the police. They said, we think that's clearer. And I said, sounds good to me. So I changed it to that. And Greg Lantzman, Chris Smitherman, David Mann voted for it. Jan Michelle Kearney voted against it. And then when it went to council yesterday, everybody said, oh, it's not clear. And I said, well, I changed it to this because you said this was clearer to you. And then Mr. Sittenfeld said, I won't vote on this unless you add my amendment to it. And his amendment was a paragraph that said, it is not incompatible to support racial justice and to say that Black Lives Matter while supporting police. So he said, I want to add that paragraph in. And I said, I accept your amendment. Let's add the paragraph. Let's just vote on whether we're going to defund the police. So I added the paragraph. I don't think he was expecting me to do that. So then he said, well, I'd also like to change. Instead of saying we don't want to defund the police, he said, why don't we say we don't want to abolish the police department? He said, I think we can all agree on that, and I think it's better to get a consensus and to have everyone vote on something. So I went to the rules of council, which I know very well, and I said, only one amendment is allowed. I already accepted your amendment. You cannot do a second amendment. So he said, well, we're not voting on it unless you change it to abolish. And then it became this whole back and forth with the law department and the mayor and me, Mr. Sittenfeld. I said, I want a vote on my motion right now. And eventually the mayor said, okay, Mr. Sittenfeld, do you want to take back your amendment? I said, he can't. There are no take-backies on amendments. It's done. It's amended. but he let him take back his amendment. And then there was a vote on whether we should even vote on my original motion.
Oh, geez.
Right. So five of my colleagues voted not to vote on it. So that was Mr. Sittenfeld, Wendell Young, Jan Michelle Kearney, Chris Seelbach, and Greg Lantzman.
So do you ultimately conclude that since they don't want to vote on it, that they actually want to defund the police department?
Yes.
How about that? It's an easy way to figure it out. I mean, they're trying to hide behind this procedural nonsense, and clearly we have proof that at least five of the nine are not interested in the police department. So I suppose when they say no to any raises that Dan Hills and the police department might wrest from the city of Cincinnati because of the fear of losing all of our officers, that when we do lose all the officers, we know exactly who to blame. The guy that wants to be the next mayor of the city of Cincinnati and his cronies. That's frightening. Real quick here, did you hear from the citizenry on this before the vote, Betsy?
So, yes, lots of profanity, lots of people cussing me out in open council chambers. And,
oh, jeez.
But, hey, I mean, that's literally how I'm treated every single day as a Republican politician. So it was not shocking for me in the least. At the end of the public comment session and the end of the council meeting, almost every one of my colleagues spoke about how shocked, stunned they were at how I was treated. I told some of them afterwards, I said, you know, this is how we Republicans get treated every single day.
Yeah.
This is not like a one-time thing, you know. I'm sorry this was so shocking for you, but this is literally how people talk to me on social media, in face-to-face, when I'm shopping at Kroger. I mean, it's the norm for me.
Yeah, I understand. That's why I stayed
the hell. They were talking about making motions so that people can't use profanity. And they were all saying, oh, you know, we're going to save Ms. Sunderman from all of these horrible words. And I said, I'm fine, guys.
Yeah.
Don't worry about me. Just
strong woman, Betsy Sunderman. You can't intimidate her with F-bombs and language, sticks and stones, etc. Betsy, I appreciate what you tried to do anyway. You at least have given us some insight into what the council members actually think. And it looks like five of them want to defund the police department on some level.
Right.
Scary.
And that's the majority, which is terrifying.
Scary. Betsy, best of luck to you, and keep fighting a good fight.
Thank you.
A real pleasure.
Stay well.
7:56. We're going to be talking to Mark Burgess, CEO of Disabled American Veterans, right off the top of the hour news. I hope you can stick around.
There will be fires, floods.
It is apocalyptic.
And vacant Supreme Court seats.
Second coming of the apocalypse.
Just keep it on. 55KRZ.
806 at 55KRC Talk Station, Friday Eve. iHeartMedia aviation expert at the bottom of the hour, Jay Ratliff, joins us every Thursday. In the meantime, pleased as I can be to welcome to the 55KRC Morning Show, Mark Burgess. He's a CEO, and I love my American veterans. He's a CEO with Disabled American Veterans. You can find him online at dav.org. Mark, welcome to the program, and let me start by wishing you a very happy birthday over at Disabled American Veterans.
Well, good morning, Brian, and thanks for having me on the show, and thanks for the birthday wishes.
Anniversary. I guess more appropriately, anniversary, but it is 100 years. You've been around since 1920.
Absolutely. In 1920, established by a local Cincinnatian, Robert S. Marks, right there in Memorial Hall.
And Robert S. Marks, I understand he received the Distinguished Service Cross in, of all things, World War One.
Yes, he did, during the Meuse-Argonne offensive. He was severely injured and was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, and right now the National Defense Authorization Act has a provision that allows for certain veterans to be upgraded to the Congressional Medal of Honor, and DAV, we're working with the Department of Army. We put him in for that upgrade. We think that his heroic measures during the Meuse-Argonne offensive warrant that upgrade to the Congressional Medal of Honor. Unfortunately, it won't be until 2023 until we find out, but we're hopeful.
Well, if I'm still around on the radio at 2023, Mark, you are welcome to come back and give us an update. We can walk through his unbelievable military career, and presumably he will get that Congressional Medal of Honor based on your efforts. But I guess in 1920, when Robert S. Marks returned after receiving the Distinguished Service Cross, very injured, that he figured out that there wasn't a whole lot by way of medical care for our disabled veterans.
No, there really wasn't much at all. It was no central organization that provided benefits for the over 200,000 injured veterans that returned. And, you know, him and other local veterans realized that, and they got together there in Memorial Hall and decided to do something about it. And they created the national organization at the time was Disabled American Veterans of the World War.
And I suppose then the mission had to be a little different because obviously now we have the VA, and of course veterans who are honorably discharged are eligible for VA benefits. All they need to do is contact the VA eligibility office and sign up. It's pretty easy to do, but that'll at least get them medical care that wasn't around in 1920. So given that, has the Disabled American Veterans Organization mission changed? How is it that you're going about helping these veterans get the care that they need?
The mission hasn't changed significantly. Of course, the major progress since the time is we do have a central agency, as you said, the Department of Veterans Affairs, and it's thanks to organizations like DAV that happened. But it is very difficult for veterans when they discharge and they transition back to civilian life. While the benefits are there, they are not automatic. It takes quite a process for an ill and injured veteran to go to the VA and file a claim and be heard and obtain those benefits. At DAV, we have claims experts all over the country, including right here in Cincinnati. And annually, we represent over 1 million veterans in their pursuit of earned benefits.
Wow.
And it's just not – it's not an automatic, as a lot of people might think.
And, you know, you speak of automatic, and one of the criticisms I have – I speak for the VA all the time, and I encourage veterans to sign up if they're honorably discharged. This is something that was earned. It's part of the compensation package when you sign on the dotted line and enlist. What a noble thing to do that is, because let's face it, when you sign up, you have no idea what's going to happen to you, where you're going to go, if you're going to be in military conflict, if you're going to be stationed in Germany. I mean, it's just a total cosmic crapshoot. But if you're honorably discharged, you're eligible for these benefits. Why aren't honorably discharged veterans automatically enrolled in VA benefits?
Well, like most everything in our society these days, it's quite a legal process. Things have to be proven. There's a tremendous amount of bureaucracy and red tape that a veteran has to weed through. And, of course, that's why we have our claims experts, and they are experts in the field. They know the system. They know how to review the medical records. They know the law and help present these claims so that the veteran does not have to do it on their own.
So you're working on behalf of veterans who are eligible for the benefits and perhaps like, for example, I have private insurance. If I get a cosmetic surgery or something and I try to put a claim in for that, they're going to deny it because it's not covered. So are the folks, the veterans you're working for, are they eligible and have already signed up for VA benefits and they're having problems getting their claims or the medical care, getting things processed, getting the prosthetic limb that they need or the PTS treatment, something like that?
There's a host of issues that any particular veteran may have to go through. And, of course, at DAV.org, we have functionality where any veteran can go and write on our homepage. They can enter their zip code, and they will find a representative local to them that they can call, and we can help them through that process.
Well, that's a wonderful thing you're doing right there. And I see there's an opportunity for folks to support and volunteer for the Disabled American Veterans. Are you still looking for that? And in what way would you might want some of my listeners' help?
Oh, yeah. We depend on our volunteers significantly. We have thousands of volunteers, and they fill a number of different roles. We have volunteers that are in the VA medical centers performing a variety of roles for patients that are in the hospital. We have volunteer drivers where we ensure that veterans are able to get to and from their VA medical appointments. And then we have local community volunteer initiatives where you can go and help build a wheelchair ramp for a veteran
yeah,
in their home, do grocery runs, do simple yard work, other home maintenance repair. And all of that information is available on our website. Anyone who wants to volunteer, if you go to DAV.org, there'll be plenty of opportunities to do that.
That is fantastic. And the number, I mean, your DAV impact statement is really something to behold. $21 billion in earned benefits you've secured for the for our veterans out there. 615,000 plus rides to medical appointments. In 2019 alone, 214,950 claims. You were talking about earlier, helping veterans get their claims processed. And it's just, you know, the idea that the need is out there for this, Mark, just comes as a bit of a shock to me.
The scope of what we do and how we affect injured veterans and have them help them have a quality of life is humbling. I mean, we do it every day, but yet we step back and we take a look at what kind of effect our organization is having, and the volunteers and the employees and the members across the country are who's making that happen. It really makes you feel good about what we do, you know, as an organization. And of course, that compensation that you mentioned, that over $21 billion, that's our claims experts.
Yeah.
That's what they do day in and day out. And of course, those volunteers, we talked about them. We couldn't do what we do without those volunteers driving veterans to and from their much needed health care appointments. And we also have an employment program.
Ah, I was just going to ask you about that.
Well, we have an employment program, and one of the things under that program are career fairs. And, of course, prior to the pandemic, those would have mostly been physical career fairs, but we've been able to pivot and shift all of those to virtual career fairs. And there's still a much need and quite a bit of attendance at these virtual career fairs. And any veteran out there that's looking for a job, go to DAV.org. We have a section there about employment. We have those virtual career fairs routinely. We have a job board. And so that's something that we would hope those that are in need will go to our website.
And I guess you're probably encouraging any employers out there that might be listening who are interested in hiring a veteran to let you know about it so they can add them to the list.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, I appreciate everything that you do, Mark Burgess. Thank you for your service to our country and your continued service to the disabled American veterans. My listeners can go to my blog page, click on the link there, or just go straight to DAV.org. Maybe an opportunity for folks who didn't serve in the American military to give a little back, Mark, huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We have a very patriotic and generous public that gives in many different ways. And those that haven't served, they recognize and support those that did. In fact, in a way that anyone could honor the veteran in their life, could go to DAV5K.org. We're having a virtual 5K Veterans Day up now through Veterans Day. So we encourage everyone to go to DAV5K.org and support the veteran in your life.
Mark Burgess, thanks again, man. I appreciate it. Congratulations on the 100th anniversary. Honestly, really wish your organization wasn't necessary, but thank God for stepping up and handling things on behalf of the veterans out there, Mark.
Thank you, Brian.
Real pleasure, my friend. Real pleasure. 8:16 right now, 55 KRC, the talk station. Stick around. Jay Ratliff's going to... Coming up on 8:21. Here at 55 KRC Talk Station, Brian Thomas right here. Glad to have executive producer Joe Strecker in there. And if you're just tuning in for the first time this morning, check out the podcast, my conversation with FOP President Dan Hills. Yeah, the police are going for raises this year, coming up with collective bargaining. I got the impression from Betsy Sunderman that contract maybe will be entered into in the spring sometime. But anyway, the debate and the discussions begin anyway, and he is hell-bent for leather that the police department deserves raises. They're basically in a combat situation these days, and we're losing officers, and a lot of them are threatening to leave, go elsewhere, just get out of law enforcement generally. And it's a shame, and I know the vast majority of us appreciate the police department, but as Betsy Sunderman talked about this morning, she was at a council meeting, and the public that was invited to comment on whether or not the police should be defunded were absolutely horrifically foul-mouthed. Well, and I guess Betsy got a little taste of what it's like to be a police officer out in the world every single day. I remember when my sister started doing the beat patrol early on in her career, and she's, of course, retired by now, but used to get yelled at and cursed at, spit at, you know, people throwing punches, all kinds of crazy things. So the disrespect for law enforcement has been around for a while. It just has never been on display to the level it is, at least these days. So see Louisville, for example. Anyway, back to before we get to Jay Ratliff at the bottom of the hour, just a couple of other points on this. Protecting against COVID-19, the Dine Safe order. And there's a fact you can find online on the Ohio State website. Well, Governor DeWine, I guess because Kentucky's now allowing bars and restaurants to stay open, and Indiana is as well, that he got a bit of a backlash from the restaurants in Ohio as well as the bars. And as of this morning, you're allowed to go back to full capacity. Today, yes. And they have some recommendations, some mandates and some recommendations. I'm struggling what the difference is between self-serve beverages, which are allowed under this directive, and soft-serve ice cream. You can't serve yourself. That makes no sense. None of it. Can a restaurant or bar offer live entertainment? The answer, yes. My musician friends got to be happy about this. One-man electrical band. You got to maintain social distance of at least 6 feet from all other people, including but not limited fellow performers. And that will allow you to perform anyway. I saw that the Menus, my friend of mine that is the lead singer for the Menus I went to high school with, they have gotten some gigs again. I was pleased to see that. Types of entertainment that are allowed in bars and restaurants, banquets and catering facilities. Now, they call them congregate areas in restaurants and bars and other facilities. Billiards, card playing, pinball games, video games, arcade games, dancing, and strolling entertainers. Those are all okay, but you still have to follow the social distancing and sanitation guidelines. Are customers and guests permitted to stand or walk around while consuming food or beverage? No. Customers and guests must be seated when consuming food, beer, wine, liquor. Because, you know, if you stand up, you get coronavirus. But if you sit down, you're going to be okay. Now, for those wondering whether you can get served booze after 10 o'clock, the answer is this doesn't address it. I think the suggestion is yes. There was no overt statement that alcohol can be served now after 10 o'clock until the appropriate closing hour. So, random, only for sitting down while you're eating or drinking. Yes. If you're just sitting down, you can still get COVID. Oh, wow. Joe, you're blowing my mind with this one. So, let's review here. In order to avoid getting COVID, make sure you are drinking or eating while sitting down without your mask. And put the mask back on if you're not eating the sandwich. And I think that's actually part of the directive here. You got to have the mask on if you're not eating or drinking. It must be the food and drink that prevents COVID, Joe. You're on to something. 825. Let's continue this. Well, let's start with a diversion away from this subject and get to Jay Ratliff, our iHeartMedia aviation expert. It's got some fun topics to talk about today, but I want to mention Bond Furniture first. It's no longer just Bond Furniture. Right now, 8:30, 55 KRC Talk Station. Very happy Friday Eve to you. Tune in tomorrow for Tech Friday with Dave Hatter at 6:30 and Ron Wilson, of course, at the 8 o'clock hour. Always enjoy those conversations, as I do every Thursday at this time. Enjoy my conversations with iHeartMedia's aviation expert, Jay Ratliff. Welcome back, my friend. It's good to have you on.
It's good to be here.
I hope you can report being well. Got to ask you that.
I am very well. My daughters, who, as you recall, are ICU nurses, frontline, they're doing excellent as well.
Thank them for their service. That's a wonderful profession. You're employed for a lifetime with a good nursing degree. I'm convinced. My wife was a practicing nurse when we met, and I'm telling you, there was always a demand for skilled nurses out there. So fantastic.
And they take good care of their dad when I have issues.
Isn't that great?
It works out well.
Jay, that's funny you say that, because I've joked many times over the years, I don't think either of my children would be alive if it wasn't for my wife and her nursing background.
Yep.
You know? All right. Give credit where credit's due. I'm married out of my league. Anyway, on to equal opportunity bird strikes. What's this one all about, Jay?
I think we can blame this on the Democrats since no one got hurt. This was Air Force Two taking off out of Manchester, had a bird strike. So impacted the aircraft. They had to do a emergency return to the airport, landed, no problem there. The vice president and his crew were transported then on another aircraft out of Manchester following the rally they have this week. But, yeah, regardless of if it's general aviation, commercial aviation, or in this case Air Force Two, birds remain one of the bigger issues for airports around the country. I mean, it's each airport has a wildlife management approach where they basically try to keep animals off the runway. They also try to keep birds away from the airport. In fact, Dallas, a number of years ago, were actually taking the birds that were involved in strikes, and they were dissecting the birds to see what they were eating. And then they were making sure that that food supply at the airport, 17,500 acres in Dallas, was removed.
How about
that? In hopes that the birds would go elsewhere to eat and therefore be well out of the way of any arriving or departing aircraft.
Well, did it work?
It has.
How about
and,
that?
There's an airport in Minneapolis, somewhere in Minnesota, that they have a dog that they send out chasing birds away. They've got somewhere they use these sonic cannon guns, if you will, to scare birds away. So yeah, they've got a lot of different approaches. One was a googly eye sign. It's you can Google that one. I'm not making that up, that some airports have used as well. So it's amazing in this era of technology how we kind of fall back to some of the simple things when it comes to trying to help manage the wildlife around airports.
And that last one sounded a bit like a scarecrow, really. Jay.
But it works. A lot of people sent me emails saying, Jay, you're making that up. Well, you know, I guess I've been known to tell a story or two, but that's not one of them.
Well, Jay, I guess now I don't like flying mainly, and I used to fly all the time. I have no fear of flying. Like I feel like I'm going to crash, I guess, until now. But it just the whole idea of being stuck in a tin can for several hours or longer and it being completely out of control and the body cavity search you get from the TSA and yada, 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 yada. There's a bunch of reasons. But assuming I'm on a plane, now you've given me something to worry about, a bird strike. How big does a bird have to be to bring an airplane down, Jay?
Well, you know, look, the birds weren't that big that knocked the engines out of the U.S. air flight that Sullenberg was flying. So, you know, when you have birds ingested into an engine, if you have enough of them, it's going to shut that engine down. Now, the good news is that those airplanes are designed, the dual engines, to operate on one engine without any problem at all, where you can successfully execute a return to the airport that you left or an emergency landing as needed. The problem is when you have a dual engine strike where both engines flame out, as we did with the Miracle on the Hudson, that's when it really becomes a problem because the bird strikes tend to happen, not exclusively, but at lower altitudes. And when that happens, the crew has a less time to basically evaluate and address the problem. If it happens at altitude, which has happened before, it's not that big of an issue because they've got plenty of time to land that airplane with regards to, you know, finding a safe place to land. It's amazing the emergency procedures that these men and women that are commercial pilots go through. And one of the reasons I'm not as anxious when I fly is because I'm very well aware of the training that these men and women go through. And when you spend so much time practicing emergency scenarios that when they occur, it's a matter of just simply reacting versus trying to figure out, oh, crap, what do I do now? It becomes a lot easier for me to you know, to relax knowing that the people in charge know what they're doing.
Fair enough. Jay Ratliff, pause for a moment because when we come back, Department of Transportation Inspector General got a comment or two about our current evacuation standards, which might be outdated. Jay's going to dive into that. We'll also get an update on hub delays after I mention CME. CME Pipelining, you'll find them online at cmepipelining.com. The only people to call if you got a sewer line problem. And the great reason to call CME, first off, well, they'll inspect that sewer line for free. They'll put a video camera down it when they come to your place, whether it's a home or a business. Inspect the sewer line with a video camera so they know exactly where the problem is and can identify what the problem is, and then they can give you an accurate quote. Up to that, no money is exchanged. Take them up on it, though, because the quote's going to be fair, and they're not going to have to deal with you're not going to deal with this second problem, which is why you call CME. CME uses no-dig technology to repair the sewer line. Up to 60 inches they can repair. 840 at 55KRC Talk Station. Happy Thursday. Jay Ratliff, iHeartMedia aviation expert. He's nationwide. He gets on all the iHeartMedia programs. It means he doesn't have any time to sleep because there's like 750 stations. Right, Jay?
Sleep is an interruption to our day, and you know that well.
I do. Anyway, what's the story on the evacuation standards? You're talking about, like, if the plane is on the ground and we got to use the slides that pop out the side or otherwise get off the plane, Jay?
Yeah, it's an overview from the Department of Transportation Inspector General who's saying, look, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, has had in place for a number of decades a 90-second evacuation rule, basically a performance-based safety rule that they have in place that states that any aircraft that's being flown commercially, you have to be able to prove that you can evacuate every person off that aircraft, a full flight, in 90 seconds or less.
That seems like a short amount of time.
Said, I'm sorry?
I said that doesn't seem like a lot of time. I mean, that's a fairly short window, isn't it? With you got 90 people on the plane or something like that.
It is, but you know, I can point you to Air France flight 358. it was an Air France flight landing in Toronto. They landed long, poor braking conditions. It basically just continued right off the runway, down a ravine, breaks up, and it erupts into flames. They had 309 passengers and crew on board. The flight crew got everyone off in 90 seconds, less than 90 seconds, before the plane blew up. If you look at Air France Flight 358, the after images, the only question you'd have, Brian, is how many people died or did anyone survive? The men and women that are flight attendants are so incredibly trained. That's why I have no patience with people that look at these individuals as serve me my drink or, yeah, you know, like you ring a bell and they come running. I mean, these are emergency evacuation specialists whose only job is to protect us in an emergency. And the inspector general said, look, this rule, which has been on the books for some time, really doesn't reflect present day conditions by the fact that we have more carry-ons now than we've ever had before.
Oh, yeah.
We have different types of seats. We have emotional support animals. And we have this changing mindset on people that travel that for whatever reason on God's green earth that they feel like they have to stop, drop the overhead bins, collect their large overheads, bags, and then evacuate the aircraft.
Yeah.
We've seen the Air France one that I referenced, that happened in 2005. That would not happen today because we've had so many occasions where these idiots slow down the evacuation so that they can basically retrieve their carry-on luggage, even if the aircraft is on fire.
It's just stuff, man. It's just stuff.
It is. But, Brian, look, we can ban people. We can ban the mom and her two-year-old because the two-year-old didn't abide by the mask policy.
Yeah.
But we are doing nothing to these individuals who willingly place everyone's life at risk behind them when they slow down an emergency evacuation procedure. And I have been for the longest time saying we have got to fine these idiots a lot and loudly and then ban them from future travel so that we can send the message that, look, when the flight attendant says, leave your bags, get off the airplane, you do that. Because if you don't, you're basically going to be in a situation where you're endangering other people's lives. We had an Aeroflot flight, I believe it was last summer, that they had 44 people get off, and I think there were 70 or so that perished. My numbers may be off there a bit. But you can watch the video of people coming down the emergency evacuation slides, and it's not one after another. It's one, few seconds. Here comes another one. And when you see it, somebody's coming down with two or three big bags that obviously came out of the overhead storage compartment. Mm. We've had that happen here in the United States and internationally. And it's we've seen a loss of life, and yet we are still seeing nothing done to really address this. And that's what the Inspector General of the Department of Transportation is really urging. Something has to be done, and soon.
Well, I'm thinking you're in this emergency situation. I'm just trying to about implementation now. You give people the information ahead of time, you know, maybe emphasize stronger. Listen, if we are in a situation where we've got to use these chutes out the side, it means we are in a near-death situation. I can't emphasize enough. Listen, you don't grab your bags. Get off the plane. It's only stuff. It can be replaced. You're putting others' lives in jeopardy. You know, more profound emphasis on why it's so important to leave your dang bag in the overhead. But until you're in that circumstance, you know, there's not a whole lot you can do other than an education campaign.
But if you and I are the flight attendants on board an aircraft where we know probably nothing's going to happen, the last thing you and I would want to do would, you know, incite a mild panic by showing pictures of an airplane on fire.
I get it.
We don't want to do that. And nobody really pays attention to the in-flight briefing.
Well, there's that.
Air New Zealand did theirs with the entire crew naked. They did body paints, trying to get people to pay attention. It's whatever they can do. But the bottom line is when there's an emergency, you need one idiot to drop the overhead bin, and then it's like – you know, the dominoes start to fall and everybody else does it.
Yeah, so, if he's doing it, I'm going to do it too, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's a frightening thought, a reality. I'm just, now I got to worry about that, and also got to worry about birds flying in the engines. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate that.
Finally, the crews know what they're doing. We're in good shape, and with every incident, we make commercial aviation safer. So even with the Miracle on the Hudson, there was 13 or 14 recommendations from the National Transportation Safety Board on ways that we could make things safer. So we learned from them.
Fair enough. Oh, and I have to ask you on the bird bringing down the jet kind of issue. They do throw like frozen turkeys or something into the engines when they're testing them, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. In fact, there's a lot of things that are used to test the durability of an aircraft engine. It's part of the process, but there's only so much that you can do.
Understood.
To prevent, or to predict what might happen. And if that's one bird, okay, but what if it's a flock where there's 8 or 10 that are ingested into that engine? Then you've got problems. And, there's a bird strike that happens every day, and it'll hit the wing or the nose or, a part of the aircraft that's not associated with the power on the aircraft itself. And once the airplane reaches its destination, a mechanic does the inspection to make sure that everything's okay, and then it continues to be used, that aircraft, in the fleet. But, there's so many birds out there, so many different airports, that we run into this almost on a daily basis, and it's rare.
Well, that's, yes.
One will be adjusted.
Thank you. It's rare, and obviously it's rare that it brings a plane down, because we would hear about it. If it happens every single day, there's a collision, then we, of course, would have a bigger problem on our hands if it was more profound in its impact. All right, Jay, you've got to give us our hub delays. We always conclude with that.
Seattle, Minneapolis, Atlanta, and Charlotte could see some weather delays, rain, limited visibility, wind, that kind of stuff, that could approach 1 hour.
Fantastic. Jay Ratliff, always a pleasure to have you on the program. I look forward to next Thursday. In between now and then, best of health to you and your family.
You as well. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Coming up on 8:48, 55 KRC, the talk station.